that we're going to be looking at both this evening and the second and fourth Sundays in September are on the topic of what are called the five spiritual faculties. Okay. So you know, the Buddha was a great list maker, and he taught in that kind of systematic way as a means of helping people develop a sort of a cohesive or integrated understanding of certain aspects of the development of the practice that occur as you do it, that kind of work to reinforce and feed each other and have a kind of a combined or collaborative or unified effect of really enhancing your ability to understand and get something out of this practice and this set of teachings. And so that's what the five spiritual faculties are. The five are faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. In the fall series on the establishing of mindfulness and introduction to Buddhism, one of the things I do is to introduce everyone to the Dharma wheel. And the Dharma wheel is this iconic depiction of the Buddha's path to liberation, the means by which one might achieve cessation from suffering. It's an eightfold path, and there are eight spokes on the Dharma wheel. Three of those are what are called the meditative qualities, samadhi. And those are, in fact, effort, concentration, and mindfulness. Once effort, concentration, and mindfulness are established to a certain degree, what begins to happen is that the mind becomes capable of insights, which is why we call it insight meditation. Insights into all the causes and conditions in our karma and our background that gave rise to who we are in this moment in time. And insight into the very process of dependent origination itself, the co-arising of all phenomena, how we define and create each other as well as ourselves. The other wisdom factor, right intention, has to do with developing insight not into who we are in this moment, but who we may be in the next moment. That is to say, the more insight we have into our intentions and our motivations, the more likely we are to be able to speak and act and live in a way that leads to the cessation of suffering rather than the perpetuation of suffering. So the two wisdom factors are primary. And then comes the fruition of the cultivation of effort and mindfulness and concentration and the wisdom factors of wise view and wise intention that manifest into wise speech, action, and way of life. The sort of fruition factors, the Pali word is sila, okay, which the formal, probably most accurate and elaborate translation of which is to live in harmony with, sometimes also translated as morality or ethics. And so this becomes a kind of a continuous process, this movement around the Dharma wheel. As the cultivation of effort and mindfulness and concentration become greater, then more and more powerful insights become accessible and become available. The more powerful the insights into the nature of your own character and your own intentions, then the more likely you are to be able to speak and act wisely and live life wisely. And so it has this continuous and mutually reinforcing aspect as one kind of, you know, talk about following the Buddha's path. It's not necessarily a linear path. To some way, in some ways, it's kind of a spiral path like this one. You know? Spirals outward to touch the earth, to manifest, you know. Spirals inward as we become more and more in touch with, you know, the empty center of the Dharma, you know. Where the essence lies, the essence of no thingness, the essence of not self. So, if you think about those aspects, you'll notice that four out of the five spiritual faculties are already aspects of the Eightfold Path. The one that's not, which makes it in some ways for me the most interesting or intriguing one, is the faculty of faith. Pali word is sadha. And many Pali scholars say, again, not the greatest translation. It comes to us from the 19th century with the Pali scholars and the missionaries that were trying to wrestle Pali terms to the ground and come up with the closest approximation of what we find in the English language. So, trust, confidence, devotion, if you try to kind of pull those terms together, that is probably a more accurate depiction, or give maybe a more full or multifaceted flavor of what this word sadha means. You know? When we think of faith in Western traditions, it customarily has to do with sort of adherence to a set of beliefs or a creed or something of that nature. You know? I remember I was raised in quite a fundamentalist church, went to a Protestant church when I was a little kid, and at some point it became too much even for my parents, and decided we needed to kind of find a somewhat more open textured congregation to become a member of. We eventually wound up with the Disciples of Christ. And as we were kind of looking around at what was out there, you know, I really developed some sort of, you know, kind of an intriguing interest in Unitarianism. I said, well, how about we check that out? My dad says, they don't believe anything. Actually, I found that kind of intriguing, but that's not the direction that we wound up going. So, but, you know, there's a Buddhist scholar named Stephen Batchelor wrote a book called Buddhism Without Beliefs. And what he was trying to get at was that that really, you know, maturing one's practice and really developing a deeper understanding of Buddha Dharma is not a matter of clinging to a set of beliefs. You know. It's a matter of ongoing exploration and of having an initial understanding of a concept or a principle and then testing it out in your own experience and maybe having that understanding change as a result of it, or go a little deeper, finding things that you encounter in studying the Pali texts and the commentaries that are perhaps enormously off-putting, or that you just can't relate to at all for one reason or another. And the tradition here, you know, when I was growing up in a fundamentalist church, if you didn't accept everything in the Bible as the Word of God, then you were off the bus. And more so in this tradition, it's, you know, that which you find useful, use it. That which you do not, put it aside. Okay. You might find it useful at some future time. You might never. It's okay. You know, inquire, look deeply, and find what seems to resonate with you, what in your own experience seems to be true. And so that at the core is what the development of sadha, or trust, or confidence, or faith, it's where it comes from. You know, when the Buddha taught the establishing of mindfulness, what's the first foundation, the first cornerstone in the establishing of mindfulness? Come on, so we've been around this training wheel a lot, right? Mindfulness of the body and of breathing. So what he advises people to do is just sit and attend to the experience of being alive in this body. first foundation of mindfulness. And then later on in the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, he talks about exploration of what he calls the six sense bases, right? And you hear this, like I said, during our meditation, you know, to cultivate the mind unclouded by fear and longing, which is to say not wanting things to be different than they are. So he said, when you sit and you experience hearing, okay, in hearing, he says, there's just the herd, there's just the noise, you know, like when we were sitting, listening to the oscillating fan, you know, you may have found it annoying and distracting. You know, you may have found it kind of comforting, hoping that the thing is going to swing your way pretty soon, so you get a little bit. It may have become white noise, you may have just tuned it out. So there are many ways to relate to the same sense input. But he's saying, in here and there is just the herd. No stories around it. No like, dislike. Okay. You're walking around and seeing there is just the seeing. And tasting there is just the taste. So experiencing all these things without aversion. Mm-hmm. And without clinging or longing. And so in this way, what happens that we begin to cultivate the sense faculties. In other words, we begin to be able to experience things just as they are, without necessarily wanting them to be any different. Being able to be that in touch with the experience of things just as they are is kind of, which is to say, learning how to just really trust your own sense bases. Learning how to just really trust what your body is telling you about how it is to be in the world is kind of an important step. Because then it makes it easier to begin to trust what's going on in the mind as well. In starting to explore the notion of sadha, you know, faith, trust, confidence, I found that a useful starting point actually is in terms of what the teachings of the Buddha we've been looking at all this year. You know, once we did the foundations of mindfulness in October and we did the Brahma Viharas, you know, the cultivation of compassion, selfless joy, equanimity, and open-heartedness, around the time of the holidays and whatnot. And then going into the early part of this year, and we'll probably do some kind of cycle similar to this next year as well, we began to take up some of the teachings the Buddha offered of, well, what happens when things don't seem to be going quite right, you know, when you have these obstacles to concentration that begin to arise, you know, like lust or aversion or sloth and torpor, or restlessness and worry, anxiety and fear. What's the fifth of the hindrances for anybody might remember?
Doubt,
absolutely. More specifically, skeptical doubt. You know, the Buddha talked about the different kinds of doubt. One kind of doubt is the one that the Tibetan teacher Sogyal Rinpoche calls noble doubt. And that is, in fact, a form of doubt or inquiry that the Buddha encouraged. You know, come see for yourself. Don't take anything just on somebody else's word. Check it out for yourself. See if it feels right to you. Skeptical doubt is the doubt that is a combination of not taking anything just on face value, combined with a certain feeling of suspicion that you're kind of being had, that you're being somehow or another recruited into a cult or something, that somebody is trying to get you to have trust in them, place the heart upon them for their own nefarious purposes or ulterior motives. And then the third, and in some ways the most painful form of doubt, is despair, which is a combination of skeptical doubt with a complete loss of hope. Complete loss of any sense that there's going to be a way through this place where you found yourself getting stuck. So those are the three kinds of doubt that can arise. What are the objects of those, of that doubt, whatever form it takes? Classically, there's three. Doubt of the teachings is, you know, the Buddha's teachings, the Dharma is variously translated as truth or the way, how things are. Well, maybe for you they're not, you know. Maybe you don't find the Buddha's description of the nature of mind, where suffering comes from, and how it can be brought to an end, to comport with your own experience. Right? Well, in that case, the Buddha advised continue to seek, you know, look other places, look to other teachings, other teachers for answers to your questions. Okay. So you may have some doubt that the teachings are really on the beat. Or that at any rate they're not right for you. Okay. You may have some doubts about the teacher and the teaching lineage. Teachings are all right, but there's really something a little off about the way that they're being transmitted, about the way they're being shared. And in fact, there were some sanghas in the Buddha's time that collapsed because the supporting communities saw there to be a great big gap between what the monastics were teaching and how they were actually behaving. And whenever that gap gets too great, and this has been true for the last 2,500 years in Buddhist countries, then the community ceases to support the monastic sangha and it collapses. So in order for the Dharma to be accurately and adequately and truthfully conveyed, there needs to be this discernible relationship between the nature of the teachings and how they're taught. So there may be doubt about the teacher. There can also be doubt about oneself. You know, the teachings seem solid and whatnot, and I think the teacher's she or he seems to know what they're talking about, or the lineage seems sound and whatnot, but you know, I just really can't hack it. You know, my older daughter had a very good friend in junior high and high school who was a champion swimmer. She was a state record holder in some events, and was an Olympic contender and whatnot as a young woman. And she and my daughter and her friend decided it might be fun to do a triathlon together. And so they trained for it, and she thought she was doing pretty well. And she actually was on the cycling team when she went off to college, and she's quite a good cyclist, you know, and good sturdy runner. They got in the pool, and you know, her friend, of course, you know, being, you know, a kind of an Olympic contender type, you know, that was for her a piece of cake. She was probably the best swimmer in the whole triathlon. And my daughter thought she'd trained okay, but they got in the pool and they started doing laps, and her friend was just whipping back and forth, and my daughter made it through, you know, two laps, and then started the third one, and all of a sudden she kind of stood up in the pool. And her friend's mom, who was, you know, kind of her attendant and whatnot in all of her training, she was saying, "Are you okay? Are you okay?" Well, she just ran out of breath. You know? And so she was pushing herself real hard, but she came to the conclusion that maybe sort of this just wasn't for her, you know. And it may well have been that the triathlon wasn't for her, but it didn't mean that swimming wasn't for her. But the standard against which she had pitted herself turned out to just be too much. So sometimes you can get a sense of what the teachings have to offer, what these practices are all about. But it just seems too hard. It just seems like, you know, I'm just not cut out for this. You know, I don't think I can follow it. So those are the three forms of doubt that one might find arise. The cultivation of sada, of trust, confidence, faith, you know, whatever Sala literally means to place the heart upon, is the reverse of those. It's having some degree of trust or confidence or inspiration even, drawn from contact with the teachings of the Buddha. It's having some trust, confidence, or some inspiration perhaps from hearing a teacher convey the Dharma, share the Dharma. Or it might be reading a book, listening to a Dharma talk online or something. Sometimes it can simply be being in the presence of a fairly realized being and experiencing that it is indeed possible to embody these values that the Buddha kept talking about. It might be an experience that you have during practice where suddenly there's this like aha moment, and it's these things that you'd heard or had been grappling to understand or something like that become known, not just in a cognitive way, but in an experiential way. They become yours, right? They become part of who you are. To some extent, they suddenly become your living reality. And so that's the way that this trust and confidence and whatnot begins to germinate, begins to gestate, and begins to manifest in our own consciousness. In my own experience, I think it was, I lived in the Berkeley, California area in the early 1970s, and there were all kinds of folks coming through town, Asian teachers and Western teachers and whatnot, doing their shtick. And so I'd go and listen to them. It was great, you know. Tartang Tulku, Choyo Trungpa Rinpoche, great, you know, Nirvansa, great many different teachers came through, and Suzuki Roshi was over in the city in the Zen Center, and there are all these wonderful teachers to listen to. And I would occasionally hear talks that really kind of rang a bell, really kind of resonated, you know, and so I kept going to these different practice sessions and sitting with these different teachers. And then finally some friends in the Bay Area who'd been abroad sitting for years with, off and on with some of their friends there, said, well, you know, these friends that we've been sitting with have come back, and they just began to teach, you know, and turned out to be Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield and Sharon Salzberg. They're all newbies, they're all in their 20s. And this is before there was an Insight Meditation Society, certainly before there was a Spirit Rock. And they were just traveling around the country offering courses and sleeping on people's living room floors and whatnot. And so somebody said, and the other thing that was really kind of intriguing was that they weren't charging anything. You know, all these other trips, they had entrance fees. Yeah, some of them were pretty hefty. And so we went and did this retreat, you know, with them in 1975, and all of a sudden it was like, bingo, you know. I don't know if you've ever had that experience where you hear somebody give a sort of a simple or straightforward Dharma talk, and there is this real sense of deep recognition. You know, it's like you may not have heard the words before, but it's as if you're being reminded of something you already knew, right? It's like there's that kind of resonance of recognition, and you just kind of know that's true. That describes my experience. That's talking about what I feel, about what's going on. It's that person just gave words to what I feel. So it might be just the spoken word. It might be hearing a teaching conveyed in a certain way. And so you find yourself, you know, like harmonic strings on a harp, and you find yourself kind of vibrating with, or finding yourself very much in tune with or in alignment with the teaching you just heard. It might be being in the presence of a certain teacher. You know, the vernacular they're using, their manner, the words they say and how they say them, how they are with others. There may be something that you find that you really resonate with that teacher. You know, this person knows who I am. This person speaks my language. This person is speaking to me in a way that I can hear what is being said. You know, like as in my case, I heard several different Dharma teachers give similar teachings, but somehow or another, hearing them in a sort of a simpler, stripped down way from people who are basically my contemporaries. You know, no robes, no nice hats or anything. You're just sitting there in this little summer camp in the woods outside of Mendocino. But there is this certain sense of something quite genuine that was being transmitted that had really a kind of a transformative effect on me. But the one of the reasons it did have the transformative effect was that in addition to listening to these teachings, and in fact, it's the first time I heard the teachings on the five spiritual faculties. In addition to listening to the teachings, we were practicing 14 hours a day. We were doing sitting and walking meditation practice from 6 in the morning till about 9 at night, you know, with some instructions and a Dharma talk dropped in there, maybe an interview. And so the mind was getting incredibly calm and very clear, you know, very aware when the mind was being afflicted with, you know, fear and longing, and aware when the mind was relatively calm and clear and perceptive. And when the mind reaches that state of calmness and clarity, it's possible to hear the Dharma in a completely different way. Because it's kind of like your guard's down a little bit. And you're hearing these teachings and turning them over in the mind, in a mind that is exceptionally clear and bright and calm and focused. So it can be very different to hear a Dharma talk or a teaching or even doing chanting in a retreat setting than not, because of the condition that the mind is in when you do it. And so a combination of the teachings and the teacher and my own practice effort and the concentration that arose as a result of it and my ability to start to have insights into what the hell is going on in my mind and why, and why I didn't seem to be able to do very much about it. You know, all these things sort of came together in a way that made it very clear to me that I had found my path. That this, in fact, was, I'd come, felt like I'd come home spiritually in some way, right? And became eventually, you know, pretty well grounded in this particular practice tradition, this way of understanding what the Buddha had to teach. And I've since that time, you know, spent time with other teachers and other practice traditions, you know, seeking to learn what they had to offer and how they were both different from and similar to this particular practice tradition. But I'm telling my own story simply by way of explaining how this trust and confidence and faith can begin to rise, can begin to generate, and how it can become self-perpetuating, you know, as you continue to do the practice, as you continue to study the Dharma, talk about it with friends, you know, hear a talk, you know, chew the fat a little bit like we do here, you know, from time to time, that it is, again, the flip side of doubting oneself, of doubting the teacher, of doubting the teachings. You know, it's a growing sense of confidence in all those three as well. Which does not mean that down the road, other forms of doubt may well arise from time to time. You know, Jack Kornfield wrote this book called After the Ecstasy, the Laundry. That you get this, you have these, you know, can have these bright insights and tremendous faith and confidence in yourself and the teachings and the teacher and all that arise, and then at some point, you know, it feels like you kind of fall off the wagon, you know, the wheels come off and you have some kind of spiritual crisis occur, and then you can have a huge crisis of confidence in yourself, you know, severe doubt of yourself, or you find out one of your teachers has been doing horizontal aerobics with one of the yogis or something. Stuff happens. You know, people, everyone has their shadow side. And so then you begin to have some real doubts about the teacher, and they say, well, you know, I trusted this person, maybe I shouldn't put so much faith in what they had to say either, you know. And so over the years, our understanding, our relationship to this stuff really kind of begins to mature, and we have a sense not only of which teachings we find to be most right for us when, but how to apply them, become a little more skilled, and over time a little more. I know when sometimes people have asked me, you know, what's this practice really about? One of the answers that I sometimes give is learning how to be a better friend to yourself. Essentially learning how to be a spiritual friend to yourself. To be kind and compassionate and forgiving. Learning how to listen to what Ajahn Chah, the Thai Force Meditation Master, calls the one who knows, the voice within. Okay. That's confidence, that's trust. Learning to hear that voice and learning to trust it. The voice of basically your inner friend. So that's a little flavor of this quality of faith. Why is it so important? Because it is the fuel, it is the nutriment. It's the way you nourish yourself as you follow the path. It's what ultimately makes it possible to develop more concentration, deeper mindfulness. Skillful effort. It's what makes possible the arising of these insights. And that's why it's the first of the five spiritual faculties that the Buddha talked about. The faculty of faith. Sharon Salzberg's got a whole book on that topic titled Faith. I commend it to you. It's good enough. So please, let's talk about, reflect on, ask questions about anything that I may have said this evening. Please.
So Lloyd, you mentioned the beginnings of American Buddhism and the insight and we were all in the 20s. And those people, with Sarvajaya, were not particularly wise at that time. We were just collected kids, as I was when I discovered and they got that insight from the teachers that were traveling through California. And then the Sangha started here, and the spirit brought them. When we look around at the people in the Sangha, there are not many college-age 20-year-olds. Has the insight, those leaders who form the insight, is there something organically that has done that? Because I know something mentioned that you're also getting older. Is it being focused on, well, it's going to take you 30 years to get anywhere in this study? Does that turn people off? Is that hard in this culture to for people to think, well, I'll study some of that.
I think that future scholars of Buddha, Dharma, and America, the question is about was the kind of the establishment of insight meditation here in the Americas or in the West just kind of an artifact of history of the time, or does it really have legs? Is it making a kind of a meaningful intergenerational connection that will perpetuate its future? Is that more or less the gist of it? Okay. First off, when Jack and Joseph and Sharon came back and began to teach, they had spent years in Asia You know, Jack had spent years and years as a monk, mostly with, in the Thai forest tradition with Ajahn Chah, also with Ajahn Buddhadasa. Guy Armstrong, one of the teachers in Spirit Rock, also spent years as a monk in Thailand, either with Ajahn Chah or with Ajahn Buddhadasa at the Swan Monastery. Joseph and Sharon were students of an Indian teacher who was trained by Burmese monks named Munindraji, and then eventually they went and practiced in Burma with the head of the Insight Meditation Center in Rangoon, Burma, Mahasay Sayadaw. And there was another tradition in Burma also at the same time being led by a fellow named Ubai Khin, who became the principal teacher for another Indian teacher, Goenkaji. Okay. So these young Westerners were very well steeped in the ancient Asian traditions that they brought home. When they came home to teach, what they did not bring with them, they did not come back in robes, they did not continue the monastic life if that's what they'd been leading, because there was enough about Southeast Asian culture that was so inappropriate and in some ways really harmful, I think. You know, it would have fomented a lot of, it would have caused real problems insofar as conveying what the essence of these teachings were. When I sat with them, after having sat with people like Tarthang Tulku and Choyum Trungpa and whatnot, even though these people were relatively young and were contemporaries of mine, they were just teaching straight up Dharma, you know, unadorned. And it was, you know, coming straight out of the, pretty much straight out of the discourses and whatnot. And so it didn't feel to me like it was just kids talking to kids. I really had this sense that there was something quite authentic that was coming through them, you know, that really began to I began to reverberate with. They also started bringing their teachers over. They brought over Mahasay Sayadaw, you know, as soon as they could to try to give people in the West as good a grounding as they could. The insight meditation tradition in the West was brought here more by Westerners, Western teachers, than the other Buddha Dharma traditions. You know, the Vajrayana, the Tibetan traditions, brought here mostly by Tibetan teachers. Zen tradition was first brought here mostly by Japanese Zen masters, you know. So in that way, we're a little different. Jack Kornfield has a teacher's training program they run at Spirit Rock, and most of the people he's recruiting into his teacher training program right now are in their 30s, some in their 40s. He's also really putting an emphasis on trying to make sure that the Dharma is more accessible to an ethnically diverse array of audiences. So there's pretty significant emphasis on ethnic and gender orientation diversity in the people that are coming through. Noah Levine's Sangha, you know, the Against the Stream Sangha, you know, it's mostly young adults in their 20s and 30s, a lot of whom have significant experience in recovery programs. So there is really a kind of an interesting array of generational work that's going on, you know. So this particular Sangha doesn't necessarily reflect that sometimes, but it doesn't mean that it's not happening. And of course, I personally am very interested in us doing whatever we can to try to encourage a more diverse demographic within our own Sangha along all those dimensions. Is that responsive to reflections? Good. Thank you. So, Don, was there something you wanted to add?
Well, just something that I've been thinking about. On the retreat that you and I attended down at Montecitos, did you notice the demographic there, which was people in their late 50s, some into their 60s primarily? And I had a conversation with Guy about that. And it's basically that young people cannot afford those retreats.
Yes.
They're really kind of priced out. And so this brings us back around to the whole monastic tradition, where the Dharma is offered as a free gift.
Yes.
And that's alms mendicancy. And maybe in order for the Dharma to perpetuate itself, we're going to need to take a look at that again.
Absolutely. You know, the retreat that Don is talking about was held at the Vallecitos Mountain Refuge in the Tucson Mountains in northern New Mexico. It's off the grid, but it's this really, you know, wonderful century-old kind of hunting lodge retreat center where they built the Kuti's little huts and stuff out in the woods and whatnot. But depending on the kind of housing you had, it cost about $100 a night to stay there.
Well, actually more when you think about it, because there's also the Donna and everything.
That's right. That was just the basic expenses before you get to the Donna for the teachers and the staff.
Well, it was more closer to $200 a day when all was said and done, which is simply not.
Plus, you know, a lot of us are either academics or retired, and you know, so we had the time and the means to do it, and that is, and you know, I was sort of, I was among the small core people that actually founded the Spirit Rock Meditation Center in Northern California, and a concern even at that time, and one that unfortunately, you know, manifested, you know, long after I left, is that it's about the same. It's about $100 a night. Just basic expenses to stay there. And so, you know, there's a lot of, I think, fairly well-grounded concern that maybe what we're really fostering here is what one might call the upper middle path. and that if we're gonna kind of return to the roots that really cause the Theravada Buddhist tradition, at least, you know, as taught by Westerners, to flourish in the West, we've really got to figure out a way to deal effectively with those barriers.
Because retreats are important and teachers are important, but the center of that is not a teacher, it's not Buddha, it's
yes.
So in fact, the paradox is that I've been on one retreat, suddenly it's a bit powerful. But it seems almost that retreats can be sold as a product.
But can be what?
Can be sold as a product. But is, you know, the Taramandala in Tottenham Spring, I asked the CEO, is Buddhism, you know, that they market, and then it becomes the way that the path is going to retreats, and maybe that isn't the case. And having, you know, is capitalism and Buddhism compatible? We have to change the way we think and the way we live on top of just meditating and stuff.
When after Jack and Sharon, or Joseph and Sharon in particular, had been sitting in India for some time, their teachers, and same is true of Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Buddhadasa, encouraging them to, you know, you've got the hang of this now, and please, it's time for you to start teaching. You know, the West really needs to hear this. So they were actually encouraged to come back and start teaching, perhaps even before they wanted to. But with Menendraji and some of their teachers, particularly in India, where there were some gurus over there making big bucks, you know, and some of whom had then relocated to the West, and so it really became all about the American coin of the realm. But their own teachers, when they were getting ready to come back, said, all we ask of you is this, please don't sell the Dharma. You know? find a way to share the Dharma that doesn't include the profit motive. You know, because they had already seen what was happening in terms of the influx of Western spiritual seekers in India, willing to shell out serious money to get enlightened, you know. And some of the Eastern teachers that had come to the Americas were making a handsome living doing the same thing. And they were just saying, please don't allow that to happen to the Buddha Dharma. Do what you can to keep that from happening. And so that's an issue that's been kind of wrestled with ever since. The way they try to deal with it, well, the way they try to deal with it both at Insight Meditation Society and also at Spirit Rock is they have a scholarship fund. And so, for instance, when we're giving money to either one of those places, I always have it directed to the scholarship fund because it makes it possible for people to come and practice that otherwise would not have the opportunity to do so. And all that being said, I think we need to continue in our quest for finding affordable retreat settings that can allow, you know, one of the things that, one of the ways that I knew that I had found my spiritual home back in the 70s in Northern California was I was just, you know, finished doing some sitting with Trungpa Rinpoche and his Dharma Datu, and there's just a straight up monthly dues, you didn't pay it, you didn't sit, period. And we had done like the Eureka training, which cost, you know, a great deal of money, and that eventually morphed into the Diamond Way stuff, where they charged, what, $15,000, $20,000 a year to be part of that club. And then when we went on this Insight Meditation retreat, it was done, you know. They asked for funds to cover the cost of renting the facility and for the food, and everything else was donated. And that, what for me, was a very important aspect of the founding of my own faith in this tradition. And so I think it's incumbent on us, whatever our age or demographic, to do what we can to try to make sure that in some form or another, that Dana tradition gets perpetuated. Because other than that, if it doesn't, then in some ways, a lot of the value that was transmitted to the West in the Theravada tradition over the last. We've already gone over our time, and so let's take just a minute or two to get back into our sitting posture. Allowing the eyes to gently close. May we live with ease and know ease of well-being. May we be safe from all inner and outer harm. May we be free of suffering and the roots of suffering. May we rest in generosity and kindness of heart. May we awaken and be free. Thanks for coming around.